order to just get a fix on the entity. Let's read. You read it all.
Not all, but a lot of it.
Good. So let me refresh some of your memory. Okay. So let's turn to my page 89, his page 25. We read some of this last week. The canonization of Zohar and its wider influence were consequent upon the expulsion from Spain, which shook the very foundation of Judaism. The decline of Spanish Jewry was accompanied by a decline in rationalistic philosophy, with its tendency to universalism, whereas the esoteric doctrine of the Kabbalah, which became more and more intermingled with Jewish apocalyptic and expressed the yearning for national redemption, was regarded as the last hope for the spiritual salvation of the desolated people. This historical spiritual transformation, which brought the Kabbalah out of a closed circle of mystical initiates into the wider world, and also into the homes of the Jewish masses, raised the Zohar to a most exalted position, where it was surrounded by an aura of antiquity and wondrous life. In the Zohar, the mysteries of existence and of the divine were already combined with accounts of the messianic days and calculations of the end of time, so its subject matter was fully suited to the spiritual condition of a shattered generation, who were anxious to find an answer to the perplexing terrors of exile and longed to hear the steps of the Messiah approaching. We're seeing, of course, a similar phenomenon in our time, the delayed reaction to the horrors of the Shoah and resurgence of magic, mysticism, and all other kinds of anti-rationalist thoughts, cutting not only across the Jewish community, but across the world at large. Where was that little card today? So you can. This is, unfortunately, I won't be able to watch it, but that's an invitation to the show Secrets of the Bible Code Revealed on Thursday, on Friday night, I guess it is. But they're pushing the extraterrestrial aspect. It doesn't have too much to do with God. It's just simply some message from outer space. I got a call from some institution called PEER, the Program for Exceptional Experience Research. They're sort of combining the Bible Code with John Mack's treatment of people abducted by aliens and sexually abused. So we have various departments of our university well represented in this operation. So it's a phenomenon, and I'm pointing all of this out, but it doesn't only occur at the end of the 20th century, but it was something that was occurring in the middle of the 16th century as well. Okay. The printing of the Zohar in the middle of the 16th century gave an exterior impulse to the spread of the book and helped to bring its influence to bear on wider circles. This influence reached its peak in the revival of the Kabbalah in Safed and Sfata, particularly in the Kabbalah Baraita Gloria, where the intermingling of mystical and apocalyptic ideas reached their culmination. In Kabbalistic literature, after the expulsion from Spain, in particular in the Sfat and subsequent periods, the Zohar was taken to be the preeminent source of mystical doctrine, and all the new mystical ideas were made dependent on it by way of interpretation. At the same time, popular consciousness was full of stories from the Zohar. The arguments and statements in it concerning the soul, the Torah, the commandments and prayers, sin and punishment, the messianic days, and the life of the world to come, that were channeled for them by ethical writings, became the kind of popular branch of Kabbalistic teaching. In this way, the Zohar was able to achieve the highest possible status. It gained a place in the national consciousness as a canonical text, third only to the Bible and the Talmud. The Talmud and the Zohar were regarded as two aspects, the revealed and the concealed, of the divine revelation in bodies and books of scripture. And from the point of view of sanctity, the Zohar was placed on an even higher position than the Talmud. The mysteries of the Zohar are regarded as the soul of the Torah, while the laws of the Talmud form the Torah's body. Just as the soul was more important than the body, so the Zohar was more important than the Talmud. The holy status of the Zohar as representing the Kabbalah among large sections of Jewry and its superiority and sanctity over the Talmud demonstrate the victory of the mystical view of nature of Torah and the Kabbalah and of the latter's relationship to halachic literature. The view that spread before the expulsion in the combined circles of the initiates and was openly expressed even in the Zohar itself. I'm sort of impressed because Raphael Mahler, in his book written some 30 years ago, this is a great book on Hasidism and Jewish Enlightenment in Galicia, in his introduction, prophesied this turn towards mysticism. He said that he felt that there was I certainly didn't see it 25 or 30 years ago, so it's the sign of a great historian that he was troubled by the fact that there was this reversion towards anti-rationalism and mysticism taking place within Israel. He was writing already then. And,
No.
No, they didn't burn the Zohar because the Christians thought it was even superior. They're the defenders of the Zohar amongst the Christian authorities regarded it as being the true theology, which of course predicted Christianity. So for them, the Talmud was a distortion and something that had to be destroyed, whereas the Zohar could readily be accommodated. We have that today in this card because we have the Christian interpretation of the Bible codes as well represented on that program. What was I going to say? Yes.
One has to be part of one's media.
Hmm?
One has to be part of one's media.
Yeah. Yes, look, in fact, to answer your question, if we look at the bottom of page 27 in Professor Tishby's article, it says, the earliest attempt to separate the two and set up the Zohar as a hostile rival to the Talmud was made in Christian mysticism, which grew and flourished in the Renaissance period in Italy and Germany, and subsequently spread to other countries in Europe, surviving on into the 18th century. The leaders of this movement believed that the principles of Christianity were contained in Kabbalistic teaching, and in the Zohar as its earliest literary manifestation. The Zohar was thought in these circles to be sacred, a book that reflected the pure spiritual image of Judaism, which in their view was identical with true Christianity, without the distortions of the Talmud. This view gave rise to the fact that at the very time the Talmud was ordered to be burned, your question, permission was given for the printing of the Zohar with the help of Christian scholars. Within Judaism itself, this division appeared in the Sabbatean movement. This messianic movement, which was based mainly on Kabbalistic doctrines, adopted the Zohar as its banner from its very inception. But at the peak of its development, before the apostasy of the Shabtai Tzvi, it still stood on the joint foundation of the Zohar and the Talmud, or the Kabbalah and the Halacha. But during its sectarian period, which continued long after the apostasy crisis, a tendency towards extreme heresy gradually gained the upper hand, and so on. You know all of the history of the Shabtai Tzvi. And then, of course, there was the... Right. But his movement lasted well into the end of the 18th century. Well, I knew an old math professor at the Hebrew University whose name was Binyamin Amira. So that completely marked him. Because Amira is Adonenu Moreno Yerim Hodo. It's the secret name shut that stream. So I certainly knew.
Did you?
Probably descendant of the Shabtai teacher. Ask him.
Yeah.
And they took on this name, was anybody affiliated with Shabtai?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So why is there in the Kamba law that foresees Christianity, or should we say is Christian?
Yeah, because first of all, this entire doctrine of the three supernal spirit, the Christians are very easily can identify them with their construction, their Trinity. The whole theory of emanation and structure within the Godhead, which is after all completely foreign to classical monotheistic Judaism, is something which meshes in very well with them. And this excellent book, which describes how the welcome to borrow it from that. I Xeroxed from that book just the chapter on the magical elements, the fantastic Kabbalah, because of the influence on Paracelsus and via Paracelsus and the entire history of medicine. It's safe to say that a lot of the progress towards the history of medicine in the 17th century and the end of the 16th century couldn't have taken place without this rebellion of magic against Galen, which had been taking place in the 16th century. So one has to remember that in the course of the history of ideas, the Renaissance started out with a resurrection of all of the ancient Greek doctrines which had been translated through the Arabic and Jewish translators, Hebrew translators. Then it was quite eclectic. They started to translate all of these magical texts, the Hermetic texts, the translation of the Zohar, of the Ithikagya's book, and Shari Ora, and so on. And there was a rebellion against Aristotle and Galen, and it didn't only come from someone like Bacon. It was not only the practical science of the model of what scientific inquiry should be, as proposed by Francis Bacon. At the same time, there was this rebellion from the point of view of magic, and that lasted for a short while, and then by rebelling against the authority of the ancient traditions, the new sciences were able to come, and magic got displaced very rapidly in the 17th century. A figure like Kepler was half Pythagorean and half modern, and remember that Newton spent 3 or 4 years doing physics and mathematics, and the rest of his time doing alchemy or disentangling the predictions in the Book of Daniel. So most of his actual life were spent on quite mystical and occult subjects. So we shouldn't hold that magic played in the transition from the classical regime into the modern regime. But it was only a transitional role. It was only a fact. Unfortunately, within our tradition, as opposed to within the Western European tradition, we sort of got stuck in this trajectory. And I think the reasons are also fairly clear. Namely, whereas we were in the middle of all of this in the 16th century, where everything was happening. At that time, you know, the Jews had congregated within the Turkish Empire on the one hand, and within the Polish and Russian regions and in the other. And whereas there were many, many things happening in the 16th century which were cross-cultural, by the time you got to the 18th or the 19th century, these were backwards because of economic and political events, which were the decline of the Turkish Empire and the complete economic collapse and eventual disappearance of Poland. So, in some sense, we were on a particular path. The world kept turning, and we continued in the straight line, and we sort of missed the 17th and 18th century to some extent, and we're paying the price for it, unfortunately, now. All right, but let's move on. The Haskalah, of course, was violently against the Kabbalah. The Hasidim were, and as Tishri points out, there was an interesting movement in Yemen, that is, Rav Kapach's father, grandfather, was a violent opponent of the Kabbalah within Yemen. I don't know what Rav Kapach's views are. You must speak to Tzvi on this on occasion.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay.
No. All right. So, at any event, let's now begin to study our subject a little bit more systematically, and for that I will read with you the beginning of Professor Katz's article. This is in Hebrew, and I'll just give you for the next 10 or 15 minutes a running translation so we can just get started with it. So this is my page 7.
Well, we have the book that
have the...
That's
right. That wasn't translated. So I'm going to translate it for you right now. We'll just read it together in translation. I certainly cannot improve on Professor Katz, either in exposition or in scholarship or anything. So, Halacha and Kabbalah, first context. Kabbalah, like any event in the history of religion, can be investigated with various different methods and types of understanding. And to the extent that it's a religious movement that needs concepts and symbols to express its content and purpose, it seems to me that the methods of investigation of the history of ideas are the most appropriate methods to use. By investigating with this method, attention can be focused to the rise and evolution of concepts and symbols, which are the fabric, the spiritual fabric of this movement at every stage of its evolution in time. And, in fact, this method is the one that's used by the modern investigators of the Kabbalah, from Adolf Frank until Gerhard Scholem and his students, each according to the level of his ability and the depth of his understanding. Those from the investigators who excelled in a broader historical interest sometimes stepped out from the path of the history of investigation of the ideas. And in fact, the greatest of the people of this method, Gerhard Scholem, sometimes makes comments about the social importance of the discovery of the Kabbalistic mysticism, or the connection between them and various exceptional historical events. Historians whose main task is to follow social history of the Jews in its generality, like Heinrich Gretz or Yitzhak Baer, went in the opposite direction. They needed the history of the Kabbalah because this appeared to them as a factor in the path of Jewish history. According to their method, they did not have to take into account the various systems of ideas in any systematic way to investigate this various splitting of the movement into its various different branches according to various different theosophic opinions and so on. All that they had needed to know was the general movement of the general direction of the movement, the way it appeared in their connection with historical experience. It seems to me that one can develop a third approach in investigating the history of the Kabbalah by setting a goal which is sort of a compromise between these two methods. The Kabbalah appears in the spiritual world of Judaism. Judaism meaning two different things. The Jewish religion, on its practical and theoretical aspect, and the community which fulfills it and is fulfilled by it, and alongside with the various fields of thought and creativity, and various other fields of thought and creativity. These other fields are halacha, agada, philosophy, Bible exegesis, poetry, etc. From this point of view, it's permissible to ask about the connection between these different fields and these different fields of spiritual activities, which after all are neighbors. The Kabbalah meets with these because it belongs to, has a common ground, or at least partial common ground. The subject matter, the interests, and even the use of similar concepts. Because of the intimate contact between the creative, spiritual creative fields which bound one another, it's impossible that there should not be contact in both directions. An influence of the creative fields of these creative fields on the Kabbalah and of the Kabbalah on them. And in fact, if one looks into the Kabbalic literature, one sees the traces of this reciprocal relation on every footstep. This fact was, of course, not unknown to the investigators. For example, about the contact between the philosophy and the Kabbalah, many special works were dedicated, and some see that the Kabbalah is, in fact, an outgrowth of philosophy. Even the influence of Kabbalah on the poetry of poets is paid attention to here and there, and similarly, the influence that it had on the Siddur HaTfilah and in the various different Nusra'ot in the liturgy. But as far as the contact between the Kabbalah and the Halacha is concerned, which is obvious, no one seems to have paid much attention. Sometimes the Kabbalists themselves, and sometimes the Ba'alei Halacha, the Halachists themselves, who ran into points of contact between these two fields, had to deal with the relations between them. But modern investigation has completely ignored this problem. The points of friction between the paths of halacha and Kabbalah are mainly in two areas. One is which has the greater authority in practical halacha. In other words, does the halacha or the Kabbalah have practical authority? And secondly, which is the more important topic as far as devotion and time of study is concerned? The problem of authority derives from the fact that the laws of Isur and Heter, things permissible and impermissible, which is the subject matter of the halacha, are found woven in from time to time in the exposition of the Kabbalists. And this is not an accident, because the Kabbalah needs the actual mitzvot and the details of the halacha which are tied to them in order to express symbolically its ideas. And in the other direction, many exegetes use concepts of the Kabbalah in order to explain the reasons behind the mitzvot and the details of their laws. In most of these cases, the words of the halacha are brought in a Kabbalistic context, in language which is known from the halachic literature. But sometimes there are rulings in the mouths of the Kabbalists which are new, without any analog in the halachic literature, and sometimes even contradict the halachic literature. when these kinds of cases arise, the question is, the question becomes one of authority. What weight do we give to custom and to halakhic rulings which don't have any source other than a Kabbalistic one? And what is the law of what happens when the rulings of the Kabbalists contradict that which is known to us from the halakhic literature?
I may be jumping the gun, but is there a most laboring conflict between the Kabbalists?
Well, there are many, and we'll come to them. For example, putting on a tefillin in Kolomoy, a typical example, and we'll come to several of them. And I'm running out of voice, so we will stop here. And if those of you who can, please read Professor Kautz's article. I will go, if not, I will, the main subject matter for next week is just go through the details, but the sources that Professor Kautz can see. Thanks, my brother.